Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news and science in the news, debate, dialogue, discussions of healthcare policy, and the big picture, as well as the minute minutiae, all coming up today on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, before we go to the emails from last week, of which we have a couple, I wanted to put out a little announcement for those of you who are in Santa Clara and Santa Cruz counties, probably also Monterey County, although I don't have the links for that. And that's, it's West Nile season again. It's warming up and the mosquitoes are out and about. I had a intimate conversation with one just the other day, and what he had to say was, we're back and we're hungry. So, well, I guess it was a she, wasn't it? Anyway, regardless of the sexual orientation of the mosquito, the fact is they are vectors for West Nile. And if you find a dead bird, you're supposed to turn it in to the state and let them check it for West Nile virus. So if it appears to have been dead, let's see, sparrows, crows, jays, finches, birds of prey, or tree squirrels that have been dead for less than 48 hours and do not appear to have died because of an injury, there's a state hotline, 877-WNV, West Nile virus bird. Oh, that's good. Or online at www.westnile.ca.gov. So, West Nile alert. We're all hoping that we won't have any human cases this year, at least not any serious ones that we recognize as such. Nice little subclinical diseases where you're under the weather for a few days and become immune. That's what we really want. Before we go any further, I'm going to just do some emails here. We have one from Renee in Waukesha, Wyoming. Thank you for your program. My question is about my rotator cuff. In September 2009, I fell off my bicycle while crossing a railroad track. Yes, I was wearing a helmet. Hospital ER took several x-rays, including my right shoulder, since it was causing me a great deal of pain. No tears or breaks were found, but the doctor described it as angry looking. A week later, I followed up with my primary care doc. She didn't be concerned and told me to resume exercise when I felt comfortable. Well, in April, I accidentally wrenched the shoulder twice, once while scratching an itch on my right arm. I'm still interested in how she was scratching an itch on her right arm with her right arm, and once while doing some outdoor painting. I talked to my sister, and she suggested I visit a sports medicine specialist and get a cortisone shot. That seems a bit extreme to me. I've read about rotator cuff injuries and modified my exercises not to irritate it. Is this something that will plague me for the rest of my life, or will time and care heal it? Do you think I should see a specialist? Sincerely, Renee. Well, Renee, first of all, shoulder injuries come in several flavors, and yours is not one that I can diagnose from the information you've given me. The most important thing that I see with shoulder injuries is a loss of range of motion, sometimes called, when it's extreme, a frozen shoulder. And this occurs in people who, because it hurts, don't move it. It can take no more than a couple of weeks before you form adhesions in the shoulder girdle, which is a fairly complicated wrapping of tendons, ligaments, with a few bits of cartilage-lined articular surfaces. Most of the shoulder joint is actually connective tissue, and as such, it sticks together rather more easily than we would like. The fact that you hurt yourself in September worries me. September to June is just too long a bruise or a contusion, so something's changed structurally, or it set you up and now you're irritating it with your regular activity. I think you probably should go back to your primary care provider and get a very thorough shoulder exam. And if you don't receive that, ask for a referral to a sports medicine specialist. If you want to know what a thorough shoulder exam looks like, I have been playing around on the web this week looking for physical exam videos, and I've found an absolute treasure trove of physical exam information out there showing how a proper exam of the shoulder, of the hip, of the chest or lungs should be done. Now, before you go off and start faulting your doctors for not doing a thorough pulmonary exam or something, do remember that these are academic videos designed to teach medical students and not necessarily intended to describe the type of pulmonary exam that needs to be done every single time you see a patient with a cough. That being said, in the case of orthopedic exams, there are a number of maneuvers that should be taught to a primary care physician, but aren't always followed. And I think in your situation, what you need is a thorough shoulder exam. So I recommend you go online and put into your browser, I'll use the verb to Google, as I now believe that has made its way into the English language. So you can Google your exam by putting in physical exam, shoulder, and video, and you'll probably get four or five sites that you can look at with ease and see what you should expect to have done to assess your shoulder. And then go have it done and see what the assessment turns up. That's all for now, Renee, but I thought people would be interested in knowing that there are a lot of videos out there in the world telling you how it should be done right. I think that's kind of a good thing, and certainly would urge people to find out more about that. This email from Jeremy, and I thought this was an attagirl, which I want to celebrate. So right on, Dr. Dawn. What you were addressing at the end of today's episode reminds me of the open patent strategy adapted by the free software movement, basically patenting something with a license that maintains its availability to others and, I believe, stipulating to some extent the kind of license derivative work I can have. Anyway, I'd love to hear you go on about this, particularly more about the found versus invented distinction. Those of you who are regular listeners to the program would have heard last week's show in which I talked about the difficulty with patenting DNA or patenting portions of the genome and the difficulties that this is presenting in reference to a particular case in which a technique in growing stem cells that was invented by a researcher but not patented by him. He is now looking at a patent infringement lawsuit from the company that came along and patented his work. And now they won't let him use the technique he helped derive. This is sort of silly, and we need to come up with a better social policy for this, particularly in academics. I think that in the academic world, there's been a tradition of open access to information, and now that there's money to be made by exploiting these things, that's going away, and that can't be allowed to happen. Science needs that open transfer of information in order to progress, and we have to protect it. We have to protect the creative commons in science even more than in other areas. We need to develop an equivalent of open source software and public copyright standards like those that are used in the software industry to take back control of research information from the biotech corporations. So I'm interested in those people out there who are in biotech and those people who have a commentary. I'd love to hear from you. So let's go to a next email. This from Christopher in Salinas regarding nanobacteria. Dear Dr. Dawn, I've been taking tetracycline for decades and have stopped a few times. Each time, after a few weeks, I have developed dry, scaly patches of skin that were diagnosed by a dermatologist as psoriasis. If you Google the terms tetracycline and psoriasis, you will easily find sites discussing nanobacteria. I understand the guy who named it already regrets the choice, but it's too late. Nanobacteria don't get a lot of credence in the medical community, but neither did H. pylori causing ulcers until the awards were handed out. Your thoughts? Well, Chris, first of all, I wanted to talk about the observation that you've made that you do better with antibiotics. And this was also true for things like rheumatoid arthritis and other diseases that are autoimmune. Tetracycline, and in some cases erythromycin, besides being antibiotics, actually have a nonspecific anti-inflammatory effect that is a side effect of them when they're being used as antibiotics, but in your case is probably where the therapeutic effect is coming from. Although it seems paradoxical, the fact that something improves with antibiotics doesn't necessarily prove that there is a bacteria behind it. Now, nanobacteria, if you go online, are framed as particles of 20 to 200 nanometers, the smallest living bacteria that are purported to grow very slowly and only be seen using electron and atomic force microscopes. Now, let me frame the size of these things as a red blood cell is 7 micrometers. That's 10 to the minus 6. A nano is a 10 to the minus 9. So these things are literally 10,000th the size of a red blood cell. The site that talks about these, the nanobacteria, states that they were discovered in 1998 by Nobel Prize nominee Olavi Kajander as a contaminant in mammalian cell cultures that kept killing the mammalian cells in their cell culture research. They then got a actual scientific term. These things are incredibly small and actually probably don't exist. A article that appeared in the January 2010 issue of the Scientific American describes an alternative hypothesis to explain these small calcium particles. The idea is the nanobacteria form a calcium shell around themselves, and that makes them so invulnerable. But actually, these particles are probably an artifact of the culture method that was used in tissue culture. It's a form of seed crystallization, and you end up with an amorphous hydroxyapatite crystal that grows layers of protein on it, just kind of in the process of accretion. They say a rolling stone gathers no moss, but a rolling piece of amorphous hydroxyapatite in your cell culture does gather moss and also protein and other things that make it look like a bacteria when you apply certain testing to it. But basically, I don't think there are nanobacteria. I think that an alternative and much more plausible explanation was put forward in the Scientific American article, which I would encourage you to look up online and read. So let's go and try again on Beulah in Carmel and on hold. Hello, Beulah. Are you with us?
My apologies. I cut myself off at this end and I could hear you fine. I called last week about my hives and I wrote down that you suggested pediatric Benadryl, which I got, and Tagamet. But that seems to be for digestion. I wondered if I'd made a mistake.
No, you're absolutely correct. As I explained when I answered you, there are two types of histamine blockers, H1 and H2. Now, the histamine type 1 blockers are present mainly in the nose and the sinuses and the respiratory mucosa, which is why we associate that with hay fever and allergies, hence the Benadryl. The H2 blockers are found in the mucosa of the digestive tract, which is why we associate them with acid control. In fact, they are part of the natural stimulation of stomach acid. So when you block them, you reduce stomach acid, hence the association with Tagamet and ulcers or dyspepsia. However, the skin on the surface of your body where you get the hives has both H1 and H2 receptors. And so by blocking both receptors, you get a more thorough alleviation of the hives.
Oh, thank you. It wouldn't reduce my digestion. I'm trying to put on weight, on the other hand. It wouldn't have an effect on that.
Well, I think if you're using these for a couple of weeks while you go through a period of hives and waiting for that to damp down, it's unlikely to affect your digestion very much. Believe me, if Tagamet helped people lose weight by interfering with their digestion, they'd be promoting the heck out of it, you know, because weight loss drugs are big money makers.
Thank you so much. One thing I wanted to ask you, I've been looking for your petition on the web and I can't find it. Is it still up?
Yes, I believe so. It should be on the very front page of the website under the resource links.
But, resource?
Yes. So when you go to the Ask Dr. Don website, and then if you hit the resource link, there should be another link to it. Thank you very much for signing the petition. Several of the people who emailed me indicated that they had also done so. And if I can do my own little bit to help persuade Congress to get off the dime on this one.
It would help.
Well, you know, I don't have much hope. It's so funny, you know, now that there's a Democratic president, the Republicans care about the deficit. And it's
Bush.
Well, it didn't matter when there was a Republican in office, but somehow it matters now.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And just to be fair, I want to rethink that last statement I made. There probably were people in Congress making noise about Bush's huge deficit that he ran up in the war economy, but they were drowned out by the sort of rah-rah patriotism that always comes with a war. But there were probably voices in the wilderness on the Republican side of the aisle. So just to be just to those people, yes, some of you actually have a consistent value set, and we do see that. Just thank you. on to Fred in Santa Cruz. Hello, Fred, and welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well this morning, but my friend is not doing very well.
Well, tell me about your friend.
Well, she was lifting a lot of large flower pots, and this was over a week ago. And then she went and was visiting her dad, who is somewhat infirmed, and she was helping him up off the couch. And then later in the day, she had pain in her hip, and then it also went down into her thigh. And this has been persistent for about over a week now.
Mm.
And troubled sleeping, tossing and turning. And, you know, the question is, it osteoporosis, or is it just a
muscle strain? Or
Yeah,
exactly. Well, she doesn't have a big history of back problems in the past.
No.
How old is she?
60.
All right, so pretty young. Osteoporosis is unlikely. You know, you can't say never, because people who really do have bad osteoporosis will sometimes collapse a vertebrae with a sneeze. So lifting your 90-year-old dad up off the couch is definitely more provocative than that. So you can't say never, but I'd say it was pretty low probability. A lot of times what I have people do, particularly if they're asking me, okay, is this a disc? Did I blow out a disc, doctor? Is I'll have them stand up straight and lean backwards.
Uh-huh.
And if you lean backwards at the hips, you know, you need some help with balance, of course, but you're trying to hyperextend the spine back,
right.
You know, and when you do that, if you've hurt your sacroiliac, which really commonly will radiate to the hip, then that will hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And that often can be manipulated back into place by a chiropractor. There's an arthritis that can do that, but also if it's a sudden onset pain and the person was lifting, what you're describing in terms of the mechanism of injury, bracing yourself and yanking somebody up off the couch is just a classic way of doing this.
Uh-huh.
The other classic way is running on a canted street, like you take up jogging and you're mm-hmm. running on a country road where it's bermed.
Yeah.
That sort of thing will definitely do this sacroiliac twist out
mm-hmm.
phenomenon. So that would be one possibility. Discs classically hurt more when you bend forward. So if it doesn't hurt to bend back, then I have people walk their fingers down the front of their thighs, past their kneecaps, keeping the knees straight, mm-hmm. see how far down they can go.
Yeah.
And if they get a reproduction of the pain with the radiation to the hip when they do that, that's a nerve root, and that suggests that they have maybe popped out a disc or protruded a disc or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
So those are a couple of things. Now, in terms of another good trick for physical exam, you know, is this a disc or is it a ligament or a muscle?
Yeah.
Is you lean sideways, and if you lean away from the pain and it gets worse, that's ligament or muscle, because you're stretching the ligaments and stretching the muscles when you move away from the pain.
Right.
And if it's a disc, then when you lean towards the pain, towards the side of the pain, it'll get worse.
Uh-huh.
So those are like little call me at 2 in the morning and ask me, what do I need to do, doctor? Well, no, actually at 2 in the morning, I tell them they need to hang up and call me in the morning. But, you know, been doing phone medicine for a few years here, and those are some helpful things remotely in terms of figuring out if you've got findings for a disc. It's worse when you're bending forward. It's worse when you bend to the side of the pain. You need to see a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
If it's worse when you lean away from the pain, you give it a couple of weeks, take it easy. And if it's worse when you lean back, then maybe see a chiropractor, given the mechanism you've described,
uh-huh.
because sometimes a simple manipulation will take care of it. All right?
Well, thank you very much, and continue having a pleasant weekend.
Have a great day.
Right.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Catherine in Santa Cruz. Hello, Catherine, and welcome to the program. Hi.
Thank you. I really enjoy your program. I have some test results back here that are kind of staggering, and I wondered how reliable you think they are.
Okay, what kind of tests?
Sure, it's a urine test.
Okay.
It's Genova Diagnostics.
So this is a urine test for heavy metals?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay. And did the test get done just randomly, or did you take a pill and then have the test?
Well, I took the succinic acid, the DMSA.
Uh-huh, okay.
And so I was going to tell you that. I guess it's a chelator.
Right.
So anyway, the lead reference point supposed to be less than 1.4,
mm-hmm.
and mine was 30.2. Should I go on to the mercury, because it's worse?
Yes, you should.
Okay, mercury reference point should be less than 2.19, and mine is 48.11.
48.1, and this is DMSA, right? Not DMPS.
What I took beforehand was DMSA, and by the way, my doctor, my naturopathic doctor, wants me to keep taking that on and off.
We'll come back to that.
Got it.
The reason I'm asking that, and it's important, is that DMSA actually has a greater affinity for lead than it does for mercury.
Oh.
You can think of these as selective magnets.
Okay.
If I'm looking for mercury, I will generally use the other one. So the fact that you came out high on mercury with this test suggests that you have a big mercury burden as well. This mercury and this lead are sitting in probably in body fat, not in your bloodstream. So if we did a blood test on you, we might not see high levels of lead or high levels of mercury. The point of the chelating agent is that it sucks it out of storage.
Exactly.
And I like to use the metaphor of, I've got a bucket of water, looks clear on the surface. There's either an inch of mud at the bottom of that bucket, 3 inches of mud at the bottom of that bucket, or no mud at all.
Right.
And how am I going to figure out? Well, I will take a stick and stir the bucket, and then I'll take a little sample of the water and do a particle count, and that'll tell me more or less, you know, there's a whole lot of mud in the bucket, or there's a tiny bit of mud in the bucket, or the bucket's clean. You got a score that is, you know, on the high end in terms of the stirring the bucket test. It's not quantitative. So you have to be careful about those absolute numbers. They aren't absolute because there are a lot of variables there. How well did you absorb the dose? How much of a dose was done? How much water had you had? Because that's going to dilute your urine. And these things are reported as a percentage of creatinine in an attempt to kind of equilibrate them so that dehydration versus overhydration doesn't dilute out the results.
Oh, I have that too.
Right. They do the calculation there as a unit of creatinine so that there's some kind of standardization.
Right.
But numbers in the 30s and 40s like that indicates a significant body burden. So the first question you have to ask yourself is, where did it come from? You know, what kind of exposures do I have in the past? Did I work with lead? Am I being exposed on an ongoing basis to mercury? And in the interpretation portion of that test result, there's all sorts of suggestions about how people get exposures.
Right.
So you want to read that carefully and circle anything that you think might apply to you historically or currently.
Yeah, I looked for everything and I couldn't see anything except the only thing I've been able to think of is I live in a house that was built in 1880.
Well, you probably have lead in your paint.
I
don't know about mercury dust, but you know, people messed around, played around with mercury as a cure, a treatment. And so in an old house like that, there may be a floor that's got actual physical mercury, and you're not going to find those things.
Right.
But I'd also think about water and the pipes.
Oh, yeah. I had those tested about 10 years ago. I've been here 31 years.
Okay. I would get another water test.
Okay.
You want to make sure you don't have ongoing exposures.
Exactly.
All right. So as far as lead is concerned, that's rather easier than mercury. How many mercury fillings have you got?
Probably average amount. Not that many left. Most of them have been replaced with the, amalgam?
Right. So one thing you could do would be to go off fish entirely for a week and then get a stool mercury and see if you've got mercury in your poop.
Because
if you've got mercury in your poop, it's coming from your mouth, probably. And getting rid of the fillings might need to be your next priority. Okay. Now, here comes the big question. Some people handle moderate levels of heavy metal exposure, as far as we can tell, without difficulty. And that's why we don't have a good sense for what the carrier rates, so to speak, are in the general population. Because we just don't have the denominator. The only people who get tested are the people who somebody suspects might have something wrong with them. So why did you get tested?
Well, I got tested because I've been having a horrible time trying to handle my teaching job.
So mental issues.
Yeah, cognitive kind of disconnect.
All right. So brain fog's a classic mercury symptom. Lead poisoning can also do it, but I'm assuming that your blood levels are on the low side. The one scary thing
low side of what?
I'm assuming you would have normal blood levels. I mean, now you get your blood tested and prove that you don't have high blood levels of mercury or lead. You should do that, or at least have an unevoked urine.
Yes, I have one planned coming up.
I, by the way, have learned from people who know way more about this than I do that you should never do a challenge test without doing a baseline test. So I would, you know, wave my finger at your naturopath a little bit for not having done the baseline test first.
Oh, well, he knows that I'm going to be doing it. It was kind of...
I know. It's okay. All right, fine. That's just a quibble. But now you've got a symptom. You were tested. Is there a cause and effect relationship? You don't know. You really can't know. Very difficult to tell. There's some toxic breakdown products and things that can tell you whether there's ongoing inflammation. But in terms of figuring out whether or not these high lead and high mercury or relatively high levels of tissue storage are what are affecting your brain, very difficult to prove. On the other hand, I don't see that there's anything wrong with treating the system and trying to get rid of some of this body burden. Would I do it with oral or IV chelation? That's a big controversy. I personally tend to use what are called natural chelation methods that don't involve using these agents.
Oh.
There are a lot of things that you can do that will improve your body's ability to get rid of mercury and lead.
Oh.
Cleaning up your diet, eliminating caffeine, going on a natural, perhaps very high vegetable, relatively low animal protein or even no animal protein diet, saunas, low infrared saunas in particular, body brushing, these sort of old naturopathic techniques, certain things like wheatgrass and cilantro have actual binding properties. They'll bind the metal as it circulates through your digestive tract. And so you increase the amount that's draining out, that's being eliminated, and gradually you can pull down that body burden.
Would alpha-lipoic acid do that? I hear that you need that to cross the blood-brain barrier.
Well, alpha-lipoic acid is never bad at decent doses.
Right.
So, you know, 400, 800 maybe a day maximum would be very reasonable thing to do. Things that increase glutathione, like N-acetylcysteine, which is an oral thing you can take, garlic and sulfur-containing vegetables are also very good for that because they help with detoxification. So there's a lot written out there about detoxify. There's a detoxification books. There's a Dr. Klein wrote a book called Detoxify for Life that's mainly aimed at mercury. But, you know, everything that works for mercury also works for lead.
Right.
So since you're really not acutely poisoned, you're sort of cumulatively poisoned. Well, we need to do a few more tests, but just assuming you're not acutely poisoned, stirring the pot with the stick and keeping the mud circulating, maybe that's good, but maybe it also redistributes it. I mean, what worries me is, let's suppose that as you're redistributing this stuff, you've got a lot of it in your butt and your hips, and you're going to take it out of the fat in your butt and your hips and put it in your bloodstream, and some more of it's going to deposit in your brain. So that's the piece that worries me about chelation, is that little thing I said when I signed up to be a doctor, first do no harm.
Right.
So I want to be sure I'm not doing harm, and I'm really not sure I'm not doing harm with aggressive chelation. And you don't have a life-threatening thing that makes me want to take a risk for you right now.
Yeah, it's just a job-threatening thing.
Understood. But you don't even know that this is causal. So taking that risk for something that's a leap of faith, and I'm not happy with that.
I got it.
Okay.
Can I ask you something else real quick?
Real quick.
Okay. The reference range for creatinine, it was 1,032, and it was below the maximum, which is 1,328. No, that was sulfur, sorry. It says sulfur results milligrams per grams of creatinine. It was an actual... Oh, no, here's that urine creatinine, 112.14, and 205 is the maximum, I guess, they give it. 23 to 205.
That's right in the normal range. Basically, what it says is two things, what you just told me. One of which is you got a big dose of chelator, which means you're going to have a big amount of stuff pulled out. So it's a dramatic result. That's because the sulfur was so high. And number two is that, you know, those numbers are valid in the sense that you were urinating and you've got good kidney function. Okay? So really, everything I said still applies.
Yeah.
And good luck. If you want a second opinion, you know where to find me.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye.
Have a great day.
Thank you. We had an off-air comment by a caller who wanted me to ask our last caller if she was menopausal, because definitely brain fog can come on fairly suddenly at the time of menopause. That's an excellent question. As I implied but did not specifically state, brain fog is nonspecific, and there are a lot of other potential causes that need to be looked for that would be easier and safer to treat. And if it's plausible that you could be menopausal, a couple of weeks of estrogen replacement therapy will tell you whether your brain fog was due to that. And remember, things can be due to more than one cause. And if that's the case, removing the thing that kicked you over the edge may be all that's required to get back to more, well, more acceptable functioning, at least. Let's go to Doug in Santa Cruz. Hello, Doug. Welcome to the problem. Haha. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Dawn. I don't know whether my my battery is going to last, so it might drop off.
But... None of us do, my friend. None of us do.
That has like a couple of extra meanings in there, but that's really nice. What I was wondering about is, male hormone levels are supposedly go in a rhythm where from month to month there's like a rise and a fall, very similar to a woman's monthly rhythm, only it's a male rhythm. Is that correct?
I don't know about that, actually, especially not from month to month. We definitely have cycles and biorhythms and all sorts of variation.
That's a male biorhythm that went month to month where there was a rise and a fall in the amount of hormonal levels.
I really don't know about that, and I don't know how well validated it is. Given the difficulties with hormone replacement, I wouldn't try to vary the dose in, let's say, a male I was treating with testosterone, and I'm not aware of anyone who actually does try do cyclic testosterone supplementation.
So what I was wondering is that if people are going through like an up cycle and a down cycle within like a month or a monthly, you know, approximate period, and you're a male, and when you're in a period where you're supposed to be like at a restful state and you're pumping yourself up with coffee and stimulants to try and keep yourself going against your own rhythm, mm-hmm. that would not be healthy, I would think.
Well, you've sort of described what's wrong with America today. In a nutshell, we have a productivity fetish.
Do I go to the head of the class or the back of the class?
Well, that depends. That depends on your definition of success, I guess. Do you want to be rich? Then you want to keep pumping yourself full of stimulants. And like I said, we've got a productivity fetish in this country that is it has been amplified really to the point of being a fetish, and it's life out of balance completely, and we don't value balance. We don't value moderation. We value excess, and we've gotten into a real feedback loop that is just augmentation cycle. There's no suppression cycle. I don't know as a society what we do about it, because essentially what I see happening is that people just push until they drop and get sick, and then maybe they learn something when they get sick and slow down, or maybe they don't and they just grieve the loss of their ability to overdo for the rest of their life. So to get back to your question, because we have really gone far astray here, there may be a subtle rise and fall of testosterone. I am not aware of it being physiologically enough of a rise and fall, and it may very well be a result of this more basic biorhythm that is just part of all of us. We go through these ups and these downs, and I believe there's a 3-month cycle and there's a 6-month cycle, and if you do Fourier analysis you can come up with all of these different sine waves that are going on in all of our body processes, and I'm sure that's reflected by melatonin levels and hydrocortisol levels and other things that could be measured in the bloodstream, and in testosterone would very plausibly be entrained by these cycles. So the real question you have to ask is, if you supplement testosterone, let's say in someone who's hypogonadal and has low levels of testosterone and has osteoporosis and maybe has depression, are you going to throw off the biorhythm? Probably not, because I don't think testosterone is what's beating the drum for the biorhythm. I have a feeling it's being dragged along. And so I don't think there's necessarily an adverse effect to supplementing testosterone as far as the biorhythms are concerned. Obviously, when you supplement testosterone, if there's a prostate cancer, you can make it grow faster, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Does that help?
Well,
I really don't know your question.
I'm just wondering about people that are, you know, pounding coffee and taurine and various different stimulants into their system.
And they're not resting.
You know, in order to correct, you know, a normally down period that they're saying, oh, my God, you know, I don't feel that good. You know, just rest for, you know, like a day or two. You've been going for the past 20 days full on speed. You know, like let your normal cycle just go through without hitting it with more coffee.
You know what? I get the impression that you're talking to somebody
like
that
the adrenal glands would just get backed out.
Sure. You're absolutely right. They do. It's good advice. Do you have someone specific in mind here?
Well, I'm not doing coffee anymore, so I guess I'm...
Talking to yourself. A little bit.
I guess I'm like looking at it in a different perspective, maybe.
I think you've got the right perspective now, and thank you very much for the call.
All right. Have a great day. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Dave in Boulder Creek. Hello, Dave. Welcome to the show.
First, I want to tell you how much I enjoy your show. I really look forward to Saturday mornings.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So my problem is I'm a runner. I've been a runner for about 20 years, And I've had several sprained ankles along the way, you know, and usually they take about 2 to 3 weeks to heal, and then the problem is gone. Well, about 6 weeks ago, I was running, and I clipped a rock or a branch or something and strained my ankle. Bottom line is it's 6 weeks later, and it still hurts. I went to my doctor 2 weeks ago, and he sent me in for an x-ray. He thought maybe I had a fracture, and there's no fracture, so he suggested that it's a bone bruise.
Where does it hurt?
Kind of the entire joint. I have full range of motion, but as I try to extend it, it definitely is painful.
Is there pain on the inside part of the ankle?
No,
like the
outside.
Big toe? Okay, the outside, not the big toe side, but the little toe side.
Right.
Okay, good. That's a really important distinction, especially you said 6 weeks out from the injury?
6 weeks, yeah.
Because 6 weeks out, if there's pain on the inside part of the ankle, then I am worried about some more subtle structures. There's a ligament bridge there between the two of the ankle bones that a nerve passes through that can get disrupted in a quote-unquote sprain, but doesn't sound like you have that. So
no, there's pretty much no pain on the inside.
Okay. Now, it's 6 weeks, so you might actually stand a chance of still rehabbing this. One of the problems that happens with recurrent sprains is that people actually lose some of the safety mechanisms that keep the ankle from spraining, and you can get into a quote-unquote weak ankle situation. So I worry that you may already have that. 6 weeks is not all that long. So at this point, when you extend it, it hurts. Are there any other motions that you can do when you're seated and not putting weight on it that are bothersome?
Well, I'll tell you what, I've been doing a lot of work in my yard, and my yard has a slope to it, and I notice that whenever I work in the yard for a few hours, it really hurts the next day. So that, I'm thinking, okay, there are lots of tendons and things in there that I'm straining by, mm-hmm. you know, having my foot at a weird angle.
Yes, you are, and they haven't had a chance to heal. So maybe you could get yourself one of the little sports braces that are used for acute ankle sprains,
okay.
and wear that while you're doing your work, and there's one made by a company called Aircast that just Velcros around, and it kind of creates a little cradle. That plus a running shoe gives you a nice hinged brace, and it'll keep you from stressing those tendons.
So my doctor said I could pretty much do normal activity to the point of pain tolerance, and I just want to make sure that's okay and that I'm not further damaging it.
Well, that's just it. You're not letting it heal. So does that mean you're further damaging it? Yeah, it's like picking a scab. So what you want to do is not do anything that makes it hurt a lot the next day.
Okay.
Because that's, you just pulled the scab off.
Okay.
And I'm sure your mom told you not to do that.
Okay.
So that's why I'm suggesting the Aircast. If you do things that have triggered it before, wearing the Aircast successfully, that means the next day you don't hurt more, then you should start to see improvement. And a little exercise I'm going to give you.
Okay.
Every morning with that foot, draw the alphabet in the air, handwriting alphabet. So A, B, C, D, E, and so on.
Okay.
Doesn't take that long. But as you do that, you're retraining all the tendons and ligaments, and you're getting a good range of motion exercise.
Okay.
And it'll also remind you how to do handwriting, which otherwise okay. you're likely to forget.
All right.
Okay?
Thanks a lot.
Good luck.
Bye.
Bye. Let's go to Anne in Santa Cruz. Hello, Anne. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Have you discussed over-the-counter sleep aids?
I don't think so. Not in detail. What?
Okay. I've been enjoying the effects of I'll pronounce it in my way, diphenhydramine hydrochloride.
Uh-huh.
There are half a dozen different cute names for it. This is SDVS, so it doesn't matter about that. The dosage is 2 caplets, and I take one at 25 milligrams at night. It's a miracle. It works so well. I sleep so perfectly. I'm postmenopausal. But I've had sleep issues most of my life. That's all I need, and a little cup of mint tea, and I'm out for the count. I asked my family practice doctor about it, and she said I could take that for the rest of my life, and it would never do me any harm. But I'd like a second pass on that.
Sure. Actually, I'm in agreement with that in the sense that this is Benadryl. We were talking about it to Beulah earlier. One of the trade names is Benadryl. Diphenhydramine is an antihistamine. With significant sedating properties.
Again, what?
Sedation properties.
Oh, okay. Right, yeah.
The reason it wasn't all that popular, well, it was very popular for a while, but it's difficult to take as an antihistamine because it makes you sleepy. So they used to package it with some sort of stimulant, usually Sudafed or pseudoephedrine or PPA. Of course, now you can't sell pseudoephedrine or phenylpropanolamine because they can be made into crank or meth. So that's gotten all fraught. But coming back to the diphenhydramine, you're exploiting what would be commonly considered a side effect. But again, the side effect is in the eye of the beholder. If you're taking it as if you're taking it for your allergies, you don't want sedation. If you're taking it for insomnia, you don't really care that it helps your allergies.
But yeah, you might
you might not like the dry mouth, and you might call the dry mouth a side effect.
Right.
So is it going to hurt you long term? No. And we have tons of data. The difficulty is when you get into your 70s and 80s, because your ability to burn through it and wear it down, in other words, the half-life of the drug extends. And so when you get older and you start having problems with dizziness and balance and you lose a few more brain cells and get a little foggy in the head, then you may have to find something else because it'll aggravate all of those things.
So it can affect memory?
It will if your memory is already compromised. Think about it as, you're taking the nerve cell and making it a little bit drowsy. If you've got reserve, then you're not going to notice
that.
But when you lose the reserve, then at that point you have to stop it because you need you need everything you got.
Every little bit you have left.
Exactly.
Well, I'm 66. I think I've got a little time on that one, and I'm pretty good care of myself mentally. It's just such a dream thing, and I only take half of the prescribed.
I'm just glad you're getting good sleep with it.
12-year-olds are allowed to take two at least.
Yeah, I always have people take the lowest.
Take
the lowest effective dose, and maybe someday your enzymes will be induced in your liver, and you'll need to take a pediatric dose, the whole pediatric dose. Don't worry about that if it happens.
Yeah, well, that comes around when you come around full circle. Everything else becomes rather childlike. So all we do is pediatric everything, huh?
Yes, exactly.
Thank you. That's reassuring. I'm glad to have the good news.
All right. Very good.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. We've got a little bit of time left over, so let me talk about a new study looking at one of the mechanisms for acupuncture pain control. This was published in Nature Neuroscience, and the lead author is someone named Niedergaard. This was a research group looking at exactly what happens when you stick an acupuncture needle into body tissue. They were using mice and giving the mice a sore paw and then measuring how the acupuncture improved the mice's ability to walk on that paw. And they had a validated scoring system. And what they found was that when you did acupuncture on normal mice, they had a drop in their paw pain of about 60%. And they started measuring tissue levels to figure out what was going on. And what they found was that when the needle is placed, the cells release ATP, which then binds to receptors on the surfaces of the nerves, which are called purinergic receptors. And the ATP gets broken down into phosphorus and adenosine. And adenosine then hits something called the adenosine A1 receptor, which turns down this small fiber pain that is associated with the kind of deep achiness that goes with, basically that deep achiness that goes with any kind of pain. I mean, I'm sure you've all had the experience of cutting yourself or hurting yourself. First, there's a sharp pain, then there's kind of a delay, and then you get this kind of achy soreness that we all know so well, and you know that one's going to be with you for a while. Well, the adenosine receptors would be affecting that second level achy soreness. So it's an attempt to establish the actual mechanism for pain relief in acupuncture. What they did then was they took mice that had been genetically engineered not to have the adenosine A1 receptor, and they did acupuncture on them, and they compared whether or not they saw the pain relief that they saw in the normal mice, and in fact, they did not. So this is an important piece of information in helping us understand that, yes, acupuncture really does do things for pain, number one. And number two, understanding the local mechanism, because we've had a sense for the broader mechanism. We've talked before about what's going on in the central nervous system, in the nucleus accumbens, which is where the pain sensors are. We've talked about how it's affecting the endorphin release in the basal ganglia, and we've also talked about the enkephalins in the spinal cord. But this is the final piece of what's going on with acupuncture, where it's affecting local tissue levels of an important neurotransmitter that directly impacts the nerves and shuts down the transmission of the pain signal. So, you know, mice, horses, dogs, you can always say acupuncture is just placebo, but the fact that it's been so broadly researched and broadly demonstrated, far more papers written that establish the effectiveness of acupuncture for pain have been done on any other pain modality, and that includes things like morphine and codeine. So, you know, take a deep breath, folks, and admit that it's a real thing, or at least I'm saying that to my scientific colleagues who still occasionally, because they haven't kept up with the literature, talk about how this is just a placebo effect. We've got a couple of moments, and so I want to take that time to raise an issue which we will be coming back to, I think. And it's kind of a twin bookmark issue to what we were talking about earlier about patents and biotech companies and ownership of the genome or portions of the genome or cloning techniques. But this one has to do with what I see as, well, let's just say that a lot of people are potentially going to have to be hurt before the regulatory agencies figure out how to regulate. But we need to start thinking about this and contributions from people who do work in this environment, and also just a heads up to people who do work in this environment. And I'm talking about biotech workers. As we start dealing with nano drugs, as we start genetically engineering organisms, trying for all of these biologicals, we run into a type of industrial complex that has different concerns for worker safety. I mean, the occupational health and safety legislation that we currently have relates to protecting people from lead or protecting them from industrial exposures to mercury or solvents or other compounds, respiratory things that they might breathe in. But it doesn't really very well address things like biologicals. In a recent survey, the NIH basically was looking to see how much information they get from level two labs about problems. They did a survey. This is a group in Texas called the Sunshine Project. And it went and asked 355 academic, government, and industrial agencies that were doing level two biological work. This is where you're, you know, working with organisms that are potentially contagious. And they were looking to see about whether there was a biosafety committee, whether that biosafety committee actually looked at the projects and the technologies and the safety measures that were going to be taken by the investigators and either okayed or nixed the project. And what they found was that fewer than 20% of the groups that were asked to provide information provided it. Now, in some cases, it turned out there was not even a biosafety committee or that the committee existed but had never met. This is not just true for private industry. This is true for the academic community as well. Now, I'm proud to say that in our own local Santa Cruz community, UCSC has a very active biological health and safety committee, of which I'm a proud member. And we do look at every project and kick projects back when it seems that proper safety measures are not being taken. But the thing that worries me about my own community is not that we don't have good oversight and we don't have good rules, but that we don't have good ways of modifying the behavior of the investigators and the students. We don't have good ways of ensuring or insisting or encouraging that the appropriate safety measures that we've outlined are actually followed. And that's really scary. Again, harking back to what we discussed last week, we've been thinking in terms of boundary conditions. We've been thinking in terms of providing barriers and fences. But we haven't been looking inside the boundaries to try and figure out how we can influence the feedback loops that will cause the behavior to self-regulate in the direction we want it to go. What we really want to do is look at how can we make the researchers and the people who are doing the investigative work choose to follow the appropriate protocols, not because there's a rule against violating them, but because there's actually a reason to go there, to want to go there. Maybe that's education. Maybe that's just reinforcement. I'll tell you, in terms of reinforcement, it has been very important to just put those little biological gel things out. And we've seen a big improvement in hand washing at the hospital just from having a way to wash your hands easily. We've come to the end of another hour. This is Dr. Dawn for now saying so long and stay healthy.